The leader of the police team was Inspector Niels Henrik Johansson. He climbed out, straightened his shoulder belt, and looked at the sorry creature on the ground. Oberg stopped bandaging Lundin's foot and gave Johansson a wry look.
"I'm the one who called."
"You reported shots being fired."
"I reported that I heard a single shot and came over to investigate and found these guys. This one has been shot in the foot and beaten up pretty badly. I think he needs an ambulance."
Oberg glanced towards the police van.
"I see you got the other guy. He was out cold when I arrived, but he didn't seem to be wounded. He came to after a while, but he didn't stick around to help his buddy."
Holmberg arrived at the same time as the police from Södertälje, just as the ambulance was driving away. He was given a brief rundown of the team's observations. Neither Lundin nor Niemannen had been willing to explain how he came to be there. Lundin was hardly in any condition to talk at all.
"So, two bikers in leathers, one Harley Davidson, one gunshot victim and no weapon. Have I got it right?" Holmberg said.
Johansson nodded.
"Should we discount that one of these macho heroes rode bitch?"
"I think that would be considered unmanly in their circles," Johansson said.
"In that case we're missing one motorcycle. Since the weapon is missing too, we may conclude that a third party has left the scene with one motorcycle and one weapon."
"Sounds reasonable."
"And it creates a conundrum. If these two gentlemen from Svavelsjö came on motorcycles, we're also missing the vehicle in which the third party arrived. The third party couldn't have taken both his own vehicle and the bike, and it's a pretty long walk from the Strängnäs Highway."
"Unless the third party was living in the cabin."
Holmberg said. "But the cabin is owned by the deceased advocate Bjurman, and he definitely no longer lives here."
"Maybe there was a fourth party who left in a car."
"Then why wouldn't the two have gone in the car together? I'm assuming that this story isn't about the theft of a Harley, no matter how desirable they are."
He thought for a moment, and then asked the team to assign two uniforms to look for an abandoned vehicle on the forest roads nearby, and to knock on doors in the area to ask if anyone had seen anything unusual.
"There aren't that many cabins inhabited at this time of year,"
the team leader said, but he promised to do his best. Holmberg opened the unlocked door to the cabin. He straightaway found the box of files on the kitchen table with Bjurman's reports about Salander. He sat down and began paging through them, his astonishment growing. Holmberg's team was in luck. Just half an hour after they began knocking on doors among the intermittently populated cabins, they found Anna Victoria Hansson. She had spent the spring morning clearing up her garden near the access road to the summer cabin area. Yes, indeed, she might be 72, but she had good eyesight. Yes, indeed, she had seen a short girl in a dark jacket walk past around lunchtime. At 3 in the afternoon, two men on motorcycles had driven by. They made an appalling racket. And shortly after that, the girl had gone back the other way on one of the motorcycles. Or maybe on a different one altogether. Well, it looked like the girl, but in the helmet she could not be 100% certain. And then the police cars started arriving. Just as Holmberg was getting this statement, Anderson arrived at the cabin.
"What's happening here?" he said.
Holmberg looked glumly at his colleague.
"I don't quite know how to explain this to you," he said.
"Jäger, are you trying to tell me that Salander turned up at Bjurman's cabin and all by herself beat the shit out of the top echelon of the Svavelsjö MC?"
Boblanski sounded tense.
"Well, she was trained by Paolo Roberto."
"Jäger, please, give me a break."
"Okay, listen to this. Magnus Lundin has a bullet wound in his foot, which is going to do him permanent damage. The bullet went out the back of his heel, blew his boot to kingdom come."
"At least you didn't shoot him in the head."
"Apparently that wasn't necessary. According to the local team, Lundin has serious injuries to his face. A broken jaw and two teeth knocked out. The medics suspected a concussion. Besides the gunshot wound to his foot, he also has a massive pain in his abdomen."
"How's Niemannen doing?"
"He seems unhurt. But according to the old man who called in, he was unconscious when he arrived. Niemannen came to after a while and was trying to leave just as the Strängnäs team got there."
Boblanski was speechless.
"There's one mysterious detail," Holmberg said.
"Another one?"
"Niemannen's leather vest. He came here on his bike.
Yes?
It was ripped.
What do you mean, ripped?
There's a chunk missing. About 8 by 8 inches cut out of the back of it, just where Svavelshire MC has its insignia.
Boblanski raised his eyebrows.
Why would Salander cut a square out of his vest? For a trophy? For revenge? But revenge for what?
No idea. But I thought of one other thing, Holmberg said. Magnus Lundin is a hefty guy with a ponytail. One of the guys who kidnapped Salander's girlfriend had a beer belly and a ponytail.
Salander had not had such a rush since she visited Gröna Lund amusement park several years before and rode on the freefall. She went on it 3 times and could have gone another 3 if she'd had the money. It was one thing to ride a 125cc lightweight Kawasaki, which was really no more than a heavily souped-up moped, but it was something else entirely to maintain control of a 1450cc Harley-Davidson. Her first 300 yards on Bjurman's badly maintained forest track was a regular roller coaster, and she felt like a living gyro. Twice she almost rode into the woods before at last second she managed to regain control of the hog. The helmet kept slipping down and masking her vision, even though she had put in some extra stuffing, using a piece of leather she'd cut out of Niemann's padded vest. She did not dare stop to adjust the helmet for fear she would not be able to manage the bike's weight. She was too short to reach the ground with both feet and was afraid the Harley would tip over. If that happened, she would never be able to get it upright again. Things went more smoothly once she got on the wider gravel road leading to the summer cabin area. When she turned onto the Strängnäs Highway a few minutes later, she risked taking one hand off the handlebars to set the helmet right. Then she gave the bike some gas. She covered the distance to Södertälje in record time, smiling in delight the whole way. Just before she reached Södertälje, 2 blue and yellow police Volvos with their sirens on flew by in the other direction. The sensible course would be to dump the Harley in Södertälje and let Irene Nesser take the shuttle train into Stockholm, but Salander couldn't resist the temptation. She turned onto the E4 and accelerated. She did not go over the speed limit, well, not much anyway, but it still felt as though she were in free fall. Not until she reached Elfshire did she turn off and find her way to the fairground, where she managed to park the beast without tipping it over. She was very sad to leave the bike behind, along with the helmet and the piece of leather from Niemann's vest. She walked to the shuttle train. She was seriously chilled. She rode the one stop to Södra station, then walked home to Musabaka and ran herself a hot bath.
"His name is Alexander Zalachenko," Björk said. "But officially he doesn't exist. You won't find him on the National Register."
Zala. Alexander Zalachenko. Finally a name.
"Who is he, and how can I find him?"
"He's not someone you'd want to find."
"Tell me anyway."
"What I'm going to tell you is top secret information. If it came out that I told you this, I'd be sent to prison. It's one of the most deeply buried secrets we have within the Swedish defence system. You have to understand why it's so important that you guarantee my anonymity."
"I've already done that," Blomqvist said impatiently.
"Alexander Zalachenko was born in 1940 in Stalingrad. When he was a year old, the German offensive on the Eastern Front began. Both of Zalachenko's parents died in the war. At least that's what Zalachenko thinks. He doesn't really know what happened during the war. His earliest memories are of an orphanage in the Ural Mountains."
Blomqvist made swift notes.
"The orphanage was in a garrison town and was, as it were, sponsored by the Red Army. You might say that Zalachenko got a military education very early. Since the end of the Soviet Union, documents have emerged which show there were experiments to create a cadre of particularly athletic, elite soldiers among the orphans who were being raised by the state. Zalachenko was one of them. To make a long story short, when he was 5 he was put in an army school. It turned out that he was talented. When he was 15, in 1955, he was sent to a military school in Novosibirsk, where together with 2,000 other pupils he underwent training similar to Spetsnaz, the Russian elite troops.
Okay, let's get to the adult stuff.
In 1958, when he was 18, he was moved to Minsk,
to specialist training with the GRU, Glavnoye Razvedchevatelnoye Upravlenie, the military intelligence service that is directly subordinate to the Army High Command, not to be confused with the KGB, the civil secret police. The GRU usually took care of espionage and foreign operations. When he was 20, Zalachenko was sent to Cuba. It was a training period, and he was still only the equivalent of a second lieutenant. But he was there for 2 years, during the Cuban Missile Crisis and the invasion at the Bay of Pigs. In 1963, he went back to Minsk for further training. Thereafter, he was stationed first in Bulgaria and then in Hungary. In 1965, he was promoted to lieutenant and got his first posting to Western Europe in Rome, where he served for a year. That was his first undercover assignment. He was a civilian with a fake passport, obviously, and with no contact with the embassy. Blomqvist nodded as he wrote. Against his will, he was starting to get interested. In 1967, he was moved to London. There he organized the execution of a defected KGB agent. Over the next 10 years, he became one of the GRU's top agents. He belonged to the real elite of devoted political soldiers. He speaks 6 languages fluently. He's worked as a journalist, a photographer, in advertising, as a sailor, you name it. He's a survival artist, an expert in disguise and deception. He commanded his own agents and organized or carried out his own operations. Several of these operations were contracts for hits, and a large number of them took place in the Third World, but he was also involved in extortion, intimidation, and all kinds of other assignments that his superiors needed him to perform. In 1969 he was promoted to captain, in 1972 to major, and in 1975 to lieutenant colonel. Why did he come to Sweden?
I'm getting to that. Over the years he became corrupt, and he squirreled away a little money here and there. He drank too much and did too much womanizing. All this was noted by his superiors, but he was still a favorite, and they could overlook the small stuff. In 1976 he was sent to Spain on a mission. We don't need to go into the details, but he made a fool of himself. The mission failed, and all of a sudden he was in disgrace and called back to Russia. He chose to ignore the order and thereby ended up in an even worse situation. The GRU ordered a military attaché at the embassy in Madrid to find him and talk some sense into him. Something went wrong, and Zalachenko killed the man. Now he had no choice. He had burned his bridges and rashly decided to defect. He led a trail that seemed to lead from Spain to Portugal and possibly to a boating accident. He also left clues indicating he intended to flee to the United States. He chose, in fact, to defect to the most improbable country in Europe. He came to Sweden, where he contacted the security police, SEPO, and sought asylum. This was well thought out, because the probability that a death squad from the KGB or the GRU would look for him here was almost zero.
Björk fell silent. And?
What's the government supposed to do if one of the Soviet Union's top spies defects and seeks asylum in Sweden? A conservative government was coming into power. As a matter of fact, it was one of the very first matters we had to take to the newly appointed foreign minister. Those political cowards tried to get rid of him like a hot potato, of course. But they couldn't just send him back to the Soviets. That would have been a scandal of unmatched proportions if it ever came out. Instead, they tried to send him to the States or to England. Zalachenko refused. He didn't like America, and he knew that England was one of those countries where the Soviets had agents at the highest levels within military intelligence. He didn't want to go to Israel because he didn't like Jews, so he decided to make his home in Sweden. The whole thing sounded so improbable that it occurred to Blomqvist that Björk might be pulling his leg. So he stayed in Sweden?
Exactly. For many years it was one of the country's best-kept military secrets. The thing was, we got plenty of good information out of Zalachenko. For a time, during the late 70s and early 80s, he was the jewel in the crown among defectors, the most senior from one of the GRU's elite commands.
So he could sell information.
Precisely. He played his cards well, and doled out information when it suited him best. We were able to identify an agent at NATO headquarters in Brussels, an agent in Rome, a contact for a whole ring of spies in Berlin. The identity of hitmen he'd used in Ankara and Athens. He didn't know that much about Sweden, but the information he did have, we could pass on in return for favours. He was a gold mine.
So you started cooperating with him?
We gave him a new identity, a passport, a little money, and he took care of himself. That was what he was trained to do.
Blomqvist sat for a while in silence, digesting this information. Then he looked up at Bjork. You lied to me the last time I was here.
I did.
You said that you met Bjorman at your police shooting club in the '80s. But you met him long before that.
It was an automatic reaction. It's confidential, and I had no reason to go into how Bjorman and I met. It wasn't until you asked about Zala that I made the connection.
Tell me what happened.
I was 33 and had been working at SEPA for 3 years. Bjorman was a good deal younger and had just finished his degree. He was handling certain legal matters at SEPA. It was a kind of trainee job. Bjorman was from Karlskrona, and his father worked in military intelligence.
And?
Neither Bjorman nor I was remotely qualified to handle someone like Zalachenko. But he made contact on election day in 1976. There was hardly a soul in police headquarters. Everyone was either off that day or working on stakeouts and the like. Zalachenko chose that moment to walk into Nurmalm police station and declare that he was seeking political asylum and wanted to talk to somebody in the security police. He didn't give his name. I was on duty and thought it was a straightforward refugee case, so I took Bjorman with me as legal adviser.
Bjork rubbed his eyes.
There he sat, and told us calmly and matter-of-factly who he was and what he had worked on. Bjorman took notes. After a while I realized what I was dealing with. I stopped the conversation and got Zalachenko and Bjorman the hell out of that police station. I didn't know what to do, so I booked a room at the Hotel Continental right across from Central Station and stowed him there. I told Bjorman to babysit him while I went downstairs and called my superior.
He laughed.
I've often thought that we behaved like total amateurs, but that's how it happened.
Who was your boss?
That's not relevant. I'm not going to name anyone else.
Blomqvist shrugged and let the matter drop.
He made it very clear that this was a matter that required the greatest possible discretion and that we should get as few people involved as possible. Bjorman should never have had anything to do with it. It was way above his level. But since he already knew what was going on, it was better to keep him on rather than bring in somebody new. I assume that the same reasoning applied to a junior officer like myself. There came to be a total of 7 people associated with the security police who knew of Zalachenko's existence.
How many others know this story?
From 1976 up to the beginning of 1990, all in all about 20 people in the government, military high command, and within SEPO.
And after the beginning of 1990? Bjork shrugged.
The moment the Soviet Union collapsed, he became uninteresting.
But what happened after Zalachenko came to Sweden? Bjork said nothing for so long that Blomqvist began to get restless.
To be honest, Zalachenko was a big success, and those of us who were involved built our careers on it. Don't misunderstand me. It was also a full-time job. I was assigned to be Zalachenko's mentor in Sweden, and over the first 10 years we met at least a couple of times a week. This was all during the important years when he was full of fresh information, but it was just as much about keeping him under control.
In what sense?
Zalachenko was a sly devil. He could be incredibly charming, but he could also be paranoid and crazy. He would go on drinking binges and then turn violent. More than once I had to go out at night and sort out some mess he'd gotten himself into.
For instance?
For instance, the time he went to a bar and got into an argument, and beat the living daylights out of 2 bouncers who tried to calm him down. He was quite a small man, but exceptionally skilled at close combat, which, regrettably, he chose to demonstrate on various occasions. Once I had to pick him up at a police station.
He risked attracting serious attention to himself. That doesn't sound very professional.
That was the way he was. He hadn't committed any crime in Sweden and was never arrested. We had provided him with a Swedish name, a Swedish passport, and ID. And he had a house that the security police paid for. He received a salary from SEPO just to keep him available. But we couldn't prevent him from going to bars or from womanizing. All we could do was clean up after him. That was my job until 1985, when I got a new post, and my successor took over as Zalachenko's handler.
And Bureman's role?
To be honest, Bureman was dead weight. He wasn't particularly clever. In fact, he was the wrong man in the wrong job. It was pure chance that he was part of the whole Zarachenko business at all, and he was only involved in the very early days and on the occasions when we needed him to deal with legal formalities. My superior solved the problem with Bureman.
How?
The easiest possible way. He was given a job outside the police force at a law firm that had, as you might say, close ties to us.
Klang and Reiner. Björk gave Mikhail a sharp look.
Yes. Over the years he always had assignments, minor investigations from Seppo. So in a way he too built his career on Zalachenko.
Where is Zalachenko today?
I really don't know. My contact with him dried up after 1985, and I haven't seen him in over 12 years. The last I heard, he left Sweden in 1992.
Apparently he's back. He's cropped up in connection with weapons, drugs, and sex trafficking.
I wouldn't be surprised, Björk said. But we can't know for sure if it's the Zala you're looking for or somebody else.
The likelihood of two separate Zalachenkos appearing in this story must be microscopic. What was his Swedish name?
I'm not going to reveal that.
Now you're being evasive.
You wanted to know who Zala was. I've told you. But I won't give you the last piece of the puzzle before I know you've kept your side of the bargain.
Zala has probably committed 3 murders, and the police are looking for the wrong person. If you think I'll be satisfied without his name, you're mistaken.
What makes you think Lisbeth Salander isn't the murderer?
I know. Björk smiled at Blomqvist. He suddenly felt much safer.
I think Zala is the killer, Blomqvist said. Wrong. Zala hasn't shot anyone.
How do you know that?
Because Zala is 60-plus years old now. And severely disabled. He's had a foot amputated and doesn't do much walking, so he hasn't been running around Odenplan and Enschede shooting people. If he was going to murder somebody, he'd have to call the disabled transport service.
Ericsson smiled politely at Murdig.
You'll have to ask Mikhail about that.
Okay, I will.
I can't discuss his research with you. And if this Zala is a potential suspect... You'll have to discuss that with Mikhail, Ericsson said. I can help you with what Doug was working on, but I can't tell you about our own research.
Murdig sighed. What can you tell me about the people on this list?
Only what Doug wrote, nothing about the sources. But I can say that Mikhail has crossed about 12 people off this list so far. That might help.
No, that won't help. The police will have to do their own formal interviews. A judge, 2 lawyers... Several politicians and journalists and police colleagues. A real merry-go-round.
Murdig knew that they should have started doing this the day after the murders.
Her eyes lighted on one name on the list. Gunnar Björk.
There's no address for this man.
No.
Why not? He works for the security police. His address is unlisted. Actually, he's on sick leave. Doug was never able to track him down.
And have you? Murdig said with a smile.
Ask Mikhail.
Murdig stared at the wall above Svensson's desk. She was thinking.
May I ask a personal question? Go right ahead. Who do you think murdered your friends and the lawyer?
Ericsson wished Blomqvist were here to handle these questions. It was uncomfortable to be quizzed by a police officer. It was even more unpleasant not to be able to explain exactly what conclusions Millennium had reached. Then she heard Berger's voice behind her back.
Our theory is that the murders were committed to prevent some part of Doug's exposé from reaching the light of day, but we don't know who the killer was. Mikhail is focusing on someone who goes by the name of Zala.
Murdig turned to look at Millennium's editor-in-chief. Berger held out 2 mugs of coffee. They were decorated with the logos of the Civil Service Union, HTF, and the Christian Democratic Party, respectively. Berger smiled sweetly and went back to her office. She came out again 3 minutes later.
Inspector Murdig, your boss has just called. Your mobile is off. He wants you to call him.
An APB was sent out to say that Lisbeth Salander had at last surfaced. The bulletin indicated that she was probably riding a Harley-Davidson and contained the warning that she was armed and had shot someone at a summer cabin in the vicinity of Stalaholmen. The police set up roadblocks on routes into Strängnäs, Mariefred, and Södertälje. Every commuter train between Södertälje and Stockholm was searched that evening, but no one answering to Salander's description was found. At around 7 p.m, a police patrol found the Harley-Davidson outside the fairground in Älvsjö, and that shifted the focus of the search from Södertälje to Stockholm. The report from Älvsjö said that part of a leather jacket with the insignia of Svavelsjö MC had also been found. News of the find made Inspector Bublanski push his glasses up on his head and peer glumly at the darkness outside his office on Kungsholmen. The day's developments had led to nothing but bafflement. The kidnapping of Salander's girlfriend, the inexplicable involvement of the boxer Paolo Roberto, the arson near Södertälje, and bodies buried in the woods there. And finally this bizarre business in Stallarholmen. Bublanski went out to the main office and looked at the map of Stockholm and its environs. He found Stallarholmen, Nykvarn, Svavelsjö, and finally Älvsjö, the four places that for apparently different reasons were of current interest. He moved his gaze to Enskede and sighed. He had the unpleasant feeling that the police investigation was many miles behind the unfolding events. Whatever the Enskede murders had been about, it was much more complicated than they had supposed. Blomqvist was unaware of the drama at Stallarholmen. He left Smådalarö around 3 in the afternoon. He stopped at a gas station and had some coffee as he tried to make sense of what he had discovered. He was surprised that Björk had given him so many details, but the man had absolutely refused to give him the last piece of the puzzle, Zalachenko's Swedish identity.
"We had a deal," Blomqvist said, "and I fulfilled my part of it. I've told you who Zalachenko is. If you want more than that, we'll have to make a new agreement. I'll need guarantees that my name will be taken out of all your research material, and I'll need guarantees that you won't write about me at all in connection with the Zalachenko story."
Blomqvist was willing to go so far as to treat Björk as an anonymous source in connection with the background story, but he could not guarantee that Björk would not be identified by anyone else. The police, for example.
"I'm not worried about the police," Björk said.
They agreed in the end to think about everything for a day or so before resuming their conversation. As Blomqvist sat drinking his coffee, he felt that there was something right in front of his nose that he wasn't seeing. He was so close that he could sense shapes, but he couldn't bring the picture into focus. Then it came to him that there was another person who might be able to shed some light on the story. He was quite close to the rehabilitation home in Ersta. He checked his watch. He would go to see Holger Palmgren. After the meeting, Björk was exhausted. His back hurt worse than ever. He took 3 painkillers and had to stretch out on the sofa in the living room. Thoughts were churning around in his head. After about an hour, he got up and boiled some water and took out a Lipton's tea bag. He sat at the kitchen table and brooded. Could he trust Blomqvist? He was now at the man's mercy. But he had held back the crucial information— Zala's identity and his role in the whole drama. How the hell had he landed in this mess? All he did was pay some whores. He was a bachelor. That 16-year-old bitch hadn't even pretended that she liked him. He had felt her disgust. Fucking cunt. If she hadn't been so young. If she'd been at least 20, it wouldn't have looked so bad. Blomqvist detested him too and made no effort to hide it.
Zalachenko.
A pimp. What irony. He had fucked Zalachenko's whores, but Zalachenko had been smart enough to stay in the background.
Bjurman and Salander. And Blomqvist.
A way out. After an hour of worrying, he went to his study and found the piece of paper with the telephone number he had retrieved from his office earlier in the week. It wasn't the only thing he'd kept from Blomqvist. He knew exactly where Zalachenko was, though he hadn't spoken to him in more than 12 years. Nor had he any desire to do so ever again. But Zalachenko was a sly devil. He would understand the problem. He would be able to vanish from the face of the earth. Go abroad and retire. The real catastrophe would be if he were actually caught. Then everything would come crashing down. He hesitated a long time before he dialed the number.
"Hello? It's Sven Jansson," he said,
a name that he had not used in a very long time. Zalachenko remembered instantly who he was. Chapter 28. Wednesday, April 6th. Bobolansky met Murig for coffee and a bite to eat at Wayne's on Vasagarten at 8 in the evening. She had never seen her boss so downcast before. He told her everything that had happened that day. Finally, she reached out and put her hand over his. It was the first time she had ever touched Bublansky, and there was no other reason than companionship. He smiled sadly and patted her hand in an equally friendly way.
"Maybe I should retire," he said.
She smiled at him indulgently.
"This investigation is falling apart," he went on. "It's already in pieces. I informed Ekstrom of everything that occurred today, and he just said, 'Do what you think is best.' He seems incapable of action."
"I don't want to badmouth the superior, but as far as I'm concerned, Ekstrom can go jump in the lake."
Oblansky nodded.
"You're officially back on the case, but don't expect he'll come up with an apology. Also, Faster stormed out this morning and has had his mobile switched off all day. If he doesn't turn up tomorrow, I'm going to have to get somebody to look for him."
"Faster can stay out of it, too. What's happening with Hedstrom?"
"Nothing. I wanted to have him charged, but Ekstrom doesn't dare. We kicked him out, and I had a serious talk with Armansky. We broke off working with Milton, which unfortunately means that we've lost Sonny Bowman, too. Which is a shame. He was a talented detective."
"How did Armansky take it?"
"He was crushed. The curious thing is that..."
"What?"
"He said that Salander never liked Hedstrom. He remembered she told him a couple of years ago that Hedstrom should be fired. She said he was a shithead, but apparently wouldn't explain why. Armansky, of course, didn't do as she suggested."
"Interesting."
"Kurt is still down in Södertalje. They're about to do a search of Carl Magnus Lundin's place. Jerka is fully occupied digging up bits of Kenneth the Vagabond Gustafsson. And just before I got here, he called to say that there's another body in the second grave. From the clothes, it's probably a woman. Seems to have been there quite a while."
"A woodland cemetery?" "Jan, I assume Salander is not a suspect in the murders at Nykvarn?" Bublansky smiled for the first time in hours.
"No. She had to be crossed off that one. But she's definitely carrying a weapon, and she did shoot Lundin."
"Mind you, she shot him in the foot, not in the head. In Lundin's case, there's probably not much difference. But don't forget that whoever committed the murders in Enschede is an excellent shot."
"Sonia, this is totally absurd. Maga Lundin and Sonny Niemanen are two hooligans with long police records. Lundin may have put on a pound or two, and he may not be in top form, but he's still dangerous. And Niemanen is a brutal bastard that even the tough guys are afraid of. I simply can't imagine how a skinny little creature like Salander could beat the shit out of them like that. Not that he doesn't deserve a beating, don't get me wrong. It's just that I don't understand how it could have happened."
"We'll have to ask her when we find her. She has been documented as violent, after all."
"Even Kurt would have thought twice about taking those guys on. And Kurt isn't exactly a pansy."
"The question is whether she had some reason to attack Lundin and Niemanen."
"One little girl with two psychopaths in a deserted summer cabin. I can think of a reason or two," Bublansky said.
"Could she have had help from someone? Could there have been other people involved?"
"There's nothing in the report to indicate that. Salander was inside the cabin. There was a coffee cup on the table. Besides, we have a statement from Anna Victoria Hansson, who keeps an eye on everyone's movements. She swears that the only people who passed her were Salander and our two heroes from Svavelshire."
"How did Salander get into the cabin?"
"With a key. I'm guessing she took it from Bjurman's apartment. You remember..."
"The cut police tape. She's been busy."
Murdig drummed her fingers on the table and then took a new approach.
"Has it been confirmed that it was Lundin who had a part in the kidnapping of Miriam Wu?"
"Paolo Roberto looked through mug shots of 36 bikers. He picked him out right away, no shadow of a doubt that was the man he saw at the warehouse in Nykvarn."
"And Blomqvist?"
"I haven't gotten hold of him yet. He's not answering his mobile."
"But Lundin matches his description of Salander's attacker on Lundegarten. So we can assume that Svavelshire MC has been hunting Salander for a while."
Why? Poblansky threw up his hands. Murdig asked, Was Salander living in Bjurman's summer cabin all the time we were looking for her?
I thought of that too, but Yerka doesn't think so. The cabin doesn't look as if it's been lived in recently, and we have a witness who says she arrived on foot earlier today.
Why did she go there? I don't suppose she'd set up a meeting with Lundin.
Hardly. She must have been looking for something, and the only thing we found was a bunch of files that seemed to contain Bjurman's own investigation of Salander. It's all the material about her from social welfare, the guardianship agency, and old school reports. But it seems that some of the folders are missing. They were numbered. We have folders 1, 4, and 5.
So 2 and 3 are missing?
And maybe more with higher numbers.
Which raises a question. Why would Salander be looking for information about herself? Murdig said.
I can think of 2 reasons. Either she wants to hide something that she knew Bjurman had written about her, or else she wants to find out something. But there's another question, too.
What's that?
Why would Bjurman compile an extensive report on her and then hide it in his summer cabin? Salander seems to have found the material in the attic. He was her guardian and was assigned to handle her finances and other matters. But the material there gives the impression that he was almost obsessed with charting her life.
Bjurman is looking more and more like a disreputable character. I was thinking about that today when I went through the list of Johns at Millennium. I suddenly expected his name to turn up there, too.
Good thinking. Remember the violent porn you found on his computer? Did you find anything at Millennium?
I don't really know. Blomqvist is busy checking off the names on their list, but according to Marlin Eriksson, one of the editors there, he hasn't turned up anything of interest. Jan, I have to say one thing.
What?
I don't think Salander did any of this. Hinschedder and Odenplan, I mean. I was just as persuaded as all the others when we started, but I don't believe it now. And I can't really explain why.
Poblansky realized that he agreed with Murdig. The giant paced back and forth in Lundin's house in Savalshire. He stopped by the kitchen window and looked down the road. They should have been back by now. He had a sinking feeling in his stomach. Something was wrong. He didn't like being alone in this house. He didn't feel at home here. There was a draught in his room upstairs, and there were always strange noises. He tried to shake off his uneasiness. It was foolish, he knew, but he had never liked being alone. He was not in the least afraid of flesh-and-blood people, but empty houses out in the country, he thought, were indescribably horrible. The noises got his imagination working. He couldn't shed the sense that something dark and evil was watching him through the crack in the door, something he believed he could hear breathing. When he was younger, he'd been troubled by a fear of the dark. That is, he'd been troubled until he had aggressively told off his friends, his own age and sometimes a lot older, who were amused by such weaknesses. He was good at telling people off. But it was embarrassing. He hated darkness and being alone. He hated the creatures that inhabited darkness and solitude. He wished Lundin would come home. Lundin's presence would restore the balance, even if they didn't exchange a word or weren't even in the same room. He would hear real sounds, and he would know that there were people nearby. He tried to ward off his anxiety by playing CDs on the stereo, and restlessly he tried to find something he wanted to read on Lundin's shelves. Lundin's taste in books left much to be desired, and he had to settle for a collection of motorcycle magazines, men's magazines, and paperback thrillers of a type that had never interested him. The solitude became more and more claustrophobic. He cleaned and oiled the pistol he kept in his bag, and for a while that had a calming effect. Eventually he had to get out of the house. He walked around the garden to get some fresh air. He stayed out of sight of the neighbouring houses, but stopped so that he could watch the lighted windows where there were people. If he stood quite still, he could hear the sound of music in the distance. When he felt he had to go back inside Lundin's wooden shack, he stood for a long time on the steps before shaking off the oppressive feeling and resolutely going in. At 7, he watched the news on TV4. He listened with horror to the headlines and then to a report on the shootout at the summer cabin in Stallarholmen. He ran up the stairs to his room on the top floor and stuffed his belongings into a bag, 2 minutes later he was driving away in his white Volvo. He had made his escape in the nick of time. Just 2 miles outside Svavelsir, 2 police cars, with their blue lights flashing, passed him, on their way into the village. After a great deal of patient negotiation, Blomqvist was allowed to see Holger Palmgren. He was so insistent that the nurse in charge called Dr. Sivarnandan, who apparently lived nearby. Sivarnandan arrived 15 minutes later and assumed responsibility for dealing with the stubborn journalist. At first he was not at all sympathetic. Over the past 2 weeks, several reporters had found out where Palmgren was and had used all sorts of strategies to get a statement. Palmgren himself had refused on any account to receive such visitors, and the staff had instructions to let no one in to see him. Dr. Sivarnandan had been following the case with much distress. He was shocked at the headlines that Salander had generated in the press. Palmgren had fallen into a deep depression, which, Sivarnandan suspected, was a result of his inability to help Salander in any way. Palmgren had broken off his rehabilitation therapy, and now spent the days reading newspapers and following the hunt for the girl on TV. Otherwise he sat in his room and brooded. Blomqvist remained standing at Sivanandan's desk and explained that of course he had no wish to subject Palmgren to any unpleasantness. He didn't want a statement from him. He was a good friend of Salander, he was persuaded of her innocence, and he was desperately searching for information that might shed some light on certain aspects of her past. Dr. Sivanandan was hard to convince. Blomqvist had to explain in detail his own role in the drama. Not until half an hour of discussion had passed did Sivarnandan give his consent. He asked Blomqvist to wait while he went up to ask Palmgren whether he would see him. Sivarnandan returned after 10 minutes.
"He's agreed to see you. If he doesn't like you, then he'll put you out on your ear. You're not to interview him or write anything in the press about the visit."
"I won't write a line about this."
Palmgren had a small room containing a bed, a bureau, a table, and a couple of chairs. He was white-haired, and thin as a scarecrow. He evidently had trouble with his balance, but he stood up anyway when Blomqvist was shown into the room. He did not hold out his hand, but motioned to one of the chairs by the table. Blomqvist sat down. Dr. Sivarnandan remained in the room. Blomqvist had difficulty at first understanding Palmgren's slurred speech.
"Who are you? Claiming to be Elizabeth's friend, and what do you want?"
"You don't have to say anything to me, but I ask you to listen to what I have to say before you throw me out."
Palmgren nodded curtly and shuffled over to the chair opposite Blomqvist.
"I met Lisbeth Salander for the first time 2 years ago. I hired her to do some research for me. She visited me in another town where I was living at the time, and we worked together for several weeks."
He wondered how much he had to explain to Palmgren. He decided to stay as close to the truth as possible. "During that time, 2 important things happened. One was that Lisbeth saved my life. The other was that we became very good friends. I came to know her well, and I think very highly of her." Without going into detail, Blomqvist told Palmgren how his relationship with her had suddenly ended after the Christmas holiday a year ago, when Salander left the country. Then he told Palmgren about his work at Millennium, and about how Svensson and Johansson were murdered, and how he had been drawn into the hunt for the killer. "I've heard that you've been bothered by reporters lately, and certainly the papers have published one idiotic story after another. All I can do now is to assure you that I'm not here to gather material for yet another article. I'm here because of Lisbeth, as her friend. I'm probably one of the few people in the country right now who unhesitatingly, and without an ulterior motive, is on her side. I believe her to be innocent. I believe that a man named Zalachenko is behind the murders." Blomqvist paused. Something had glimmered in Palmgren's eyes when he said the name Zalachenko. "If you can contribute anything that would shed some light on Lisbeth's past, this is the time to do it. If you don't want to help her, then I'm wasting my time and yours, and I'll know where you stand." Palmgren had not said a word during this monologue. As Blomqvist finished, his eyes flashed again, but he was smiling. He spoke as clearly as he could.
"You really want to help her?"
Blomqvist nodded. Palmgren leaned forward.
"Describe the sofa in her living room."
On the occasions I visited her, she had a worn-out, extremely ugly piece of furniture with a certain curiosity value. I would guess it's from the early 50s. It has two shapeless cushions covered in brown cloth with a yellow pattern of sorts on it. The cloth is torn in several places, and the stuffing was coming out when I last saw it. All of a sudden, Palmgren laughed. It sounded more like he was clearing his throat. He looked at Dr. Sivanandan.
"He's been to her apartment, at least. Does the doctor think it will be possible to offer my guest a cup of coffee?"
"Certainly." Dr. Sivanandan got up to leave. He paused in the doorway to nod at Blomqvist.
"Alexander Zalachenko,"
Palmgren said as soon as the door was closed.
"So you know that name?" "Lisbeth told me the name. And I think it's important that I tell this story to someone, should I happen to drop dead, which is all too possible."
"Lisbeth? How would she know anything about his existence?"
"He is Lisbeth's father."
At first, Blomqvist could not make out what Palmgren was saying. Then the words sank in. "What the hell are you saying?"
"Zalachenko was some sort of a political refugee. I've never gotten the story quite straight, and Lisbeth was always tight-lipped about it. It was something she absolutely did not want to talk about."
Her birth certificate. Father unknown. "Zalachenko is Lisbeth's father," Blomqvist repeated aloud.
"On only one occasion in all the years I've known her did she tell me what happened. Here's how I understood it. Zalachenko came here in the mid-70s. He met Lisbeth's mother in 1977. They had a relationship, and the result was two children."
"Two?"
"Lisbeth and her twin sister, Camilla."
"Good God! There are two of her?"
"They're very different. But that's another story. Lisbeth's mother's name was, in fact, Agneta Sofia Sjolander. She was 17 when she met Zalachenko. I don't know anything else about how they met, but I gather she was quite a dependent young girl and easy prey for an older, more experienced man. She was impressed by him and probably head over heels in love with him. Zalachenko turned out to be anything but nice. I assume he was just after a willing woman and not much else. Naturally, she fantasized about a secure future with him, but he wasn't the least bit interested in marriage. They never did marry. But in 1979, she changed her name from Sjolander to Salander. That was, I suppose, her way of showing that they belonged together."
"How do you mean?"
"Zala Sjolander."
"Jesus," Blomqvist said.
"I started looking into the whole matter just before I fell ill. She had the right to take the name because her mother, Lisbeth's grandmother, was actually named Sjolander. Then what happened was that Zalachenko proved himself to be a psychopath. On a grand scale, he drank and savagely abused Agneta. As far as I know, this abuse went on throughout the girl's childhood. As long as Lisbeth can remember, Zalachenko would turn up from time to time. Sometimes he would be gone for long periods, but then he was suddenly there again in the apartment on Lundegarten. And every time it was the same old story. He came there to have sex and to get drunk, and it ended with him abusing Lisbeth's mother in various ways."
Lisbeth told me things that indicated it was more than physical abuse. He carried a gun and was threatening, and there were elements of sadism and psychological terrorizing. I gather it only got worse as the years went on. Lisbeth's mother spent a great part of the 80s living in fear.
Did he hit the children too?
No. Apparently he was totally uninterested in his daughters. He hardly even said hello to them. Their mother used to send them to their room when Zalachenko turned up, and they weren't allowed to come out without permission. On one occasion he may have spanked Elizabeth or her sister, but that was mostly because they were irritating him or were somehow in the way. All the violence was directed towards their mother.
Jesus Christ. Poor Lisbeth.
Palmgren nodded.
Lisbeth told me all this about a month before I had my stroke. It was the first time she had spoken openly about what had happened. I just decided that it was time to put an end to the absurd declaration of incompetence. Elizabeth is as smart as anyone I know, and I was prepared to take up her case again with the district court. Then I had the stroke, and when I woke up I was here.
He waved at his confined quarters. A nurse knocked at the door and brought in coffee. Palmgren sat in silence until she left.
There are some aspects of Lisbeth's story that I don't understand, he said. Agneta had been forced to go to the hospital dozens of times. I read her medical record. It was perfectly obvious that she was the victim of aggravated assault, and social welfare should have intervened, but nothing happened. Lisbeth and Camilla had to stay at the social emergency service whenever she sought care, but as soon as she was discharged she would go back home and it would start all over again. I can only interpret this as the collapse of the whole social safety net, and Agneta was too terrified to do anything but wait for her torturer. Then something happened. Lisbeth calls it all the evil.
What was it?
Zalachenko had been gone for several months. Lisbeth had turned 12. She had apparently begun to think that he was gone for good, but he wasn't, of course. One day he came back. First Agneta locked Lisbeth and her sister in their room. Then she and Zalachenko went to bed, and then he started hitting her. He enjoyed beating people, but this time it wasn't two helpless little girls who were locked up. The twins reacted quite differently. Camilla was panic-stricken that someone would find out what was going on in their apartment. She repressed everything and made out that her mother was never beaten. When the abuse was over, Camilla would go in and hug her father and pretend that everything was fine.
Her way of protecting herself, no doubt.
Right. But Lisbeth was a whole different story. This time she interrupted the beating. She went into the kitchen and got a knife and stabbed Zalachenko in the shoulder. She stabbed him 5 times before he managed to take the knife away and punch her in the face. They weren't deep wounds, it seems, but he was bleeding like a stuck pig, and he ran off.
That sounds like Lisbeth.
Palmgren laughed. Yes, it does. Don't ever fight with Lisbeth Salander. Her attitude towards the rest of the world is that if someone threatens her with a gun, she'll get a bigger gun. That's what frightens me about what's going on right now.
So,
That was all the evil. No, no. Then two things happened. I can't understand it. Zalachenko was wounded so badly that he had to go to the hospital. There should have been a police report.
But?
But as far as I could discover, there were absolutely no repercussions. Lisbeth remembers that a man came and talked with Agneta. She didn't know what was said or who he was. And then her mother told her that Zalachenko had forgiven her everything.
Forgiven?
That was the expression she used. And suddenly Blomqvist understood.
Björk, or one of Björk's colleagues. It was about cleaning up after Zalachenko. Those fucking pigs.
He closed his eyes.
What is it?
Palmgren said. I think I know what happened. And someone is going to pay for this. But go on with the story.
Zalachenko was gone for several months. Lisbeth waited for him and made her preparations. She had played truant from school every single day to watch out for her mother. She was scared to death that Zalachenko would really hurt her. She was 12 and felt responsible for her mother, who did not dare to go to the police and couldn't break it off with Zalachenko, or who perhaps did not understand the seriousness of the situation. But on the day Zalachenko finally turned up, Elizabeth was at school. She came home just as he was leaving the apartment. He didn't say a word. He just laughed at her. Lisbeth went in and found her mother unconscious on the kitchen floor.
But Zalachenko didn't touch Lisbeth?
No. She caught up with him just as he was getting into his car. He rolled down the window, possibly to say something. Lisbeth was ready. She threw a milk carton she had filled with gasoline into the car. Then she threw in a burning match.
Good God.
She tried to kill her father twice. This time there were consequences. A man sitting in a car on Lundegarten, burning like a beacon, could hardly go unnoticed.
But he survived.
He suffered horribly. One of his feet had to be amputated. His face and other parts of his body suffered serious burns, and Lisbeth ended up at St. Stephen's psychiatric clinic for children.
Despite the fact that she already knew every word by heart, Salander once again read through the material about herself that she had found in Bierman's files. She sat in the window seat and opened the cigarette case Miriam Wu had given her. She lit a cigarette and looked out towards Djurgården. She had discovered some things about her life that she had never known before. In fact, so much fell into place that she turned quite cold. Above all, she was interested in the report filed by Björk in March 1991. She wasn't certain which one of the many grown-ups who had talked to her was Björk, but she thought she knew. He had introduced himself with another name. Sven Jansson. She remembered every feature of his face, every word he said, and every gesture he made on the three occasions she had encountered him. The whole thing was a disaster. Zalachenko had burned like fury inside the car. He had managed to push open the door and roll out onto the pavement, but his leg got caught inside by the seatbelt. People had come rushing up to smother the flames. A fire engine arrived and put out the fire. An ambulance arrived, and Lisbeth had tried to get the medics to ignore Zalachenko and come and see to her mother. They had shoved her aside. The police arrived, and there were witnesses who pointed to her. She tried to explain what had happened, but it felt as if nobody was listening to her, and suddenly she was sitting in the back seat of a police car, and it took minutes and minutes and minutes, and finally almost an hour before the police went into the apartment and found her mother. Agneta Sofia Salander was unconscious.